From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The show can also be heard at KCRW.com. Martin Scorsese has said about New York in the book Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York, that the city has become the great studio. It's a contribution to a great Q&A that begins the book, an amazing compilations of portraits and still photographs from movies shot in New York, basically from the 50s until the present day. The editor and the conceiver of the book, James Sanders, architect, who you may also know from the book Celluloid Skyline, is also here. James, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Tell me how this book came to you.
This was something that I was asked by the New York City Mayor's Office of Film, Theater, and Broadcasting to work on.
And you talk about basically the creation of the Mayor's Office, which started in 1965, a year in which, as you mentioned in the book, 11 films were shot here, only two which were substantially shot in New York. And by the end of John Lindsay's term as mayor, that had grown by over several hundred. Yeah.
That's right. It's really because of Mayor John Lindsay. Who's remembered in kind of mixed ways nowadays, but one of his signal accomplishments of his administration was the creation of this mayor's office for film production, which was, most people don't realize, the first film commission in the world. Now everywhere has got a film commission. Tasmania has a film commission, and Singapore has a film commission, and certainly every state in the union has one in many, many, many cities. But it was a radical new idea that there would be a government agency who would make it its business to help filmmakers shoot on the streets of their cities and territories. And until then, they'd really made it as hard as possible. But
there's the story that Delbert Mann tells about shooting Mr. Budwing here, where he basically ran into so much red tape. There was so much bureaucracy and corruption that it was virtually impossible to get a movie made here.
It's a story we actually tell two times. Once because it actually appeared unsolicited by Scorsese in my interview with him. He remembered watching as a film student at NYU when he was still in the Washington Square College, as it was called in those days, of NYU as an undergraduate, watching this feature film being made. And the point being that feature films were so rare. I mean, nowadays, of course, you run into them on every corner. But in those days, the film students couldn't believe it. So they just sat there watching Delbert Mann make this film. But what he didn't know was that Mann was having the worst time of his life. He was furious with the local unions. He was furious with just about the entire experience of it. And here, this is the guy who directed Marty. I mean, this was a Mr. New York filmmaker of his day. Said he'd never work again in New York, and he never did. But that served as a kind of a call to action for a lot of the local people. And next year, there with the election of Mayor Lindsay, there was dramatic change.
It's The Treatment. My guest is architect James Sanders. His book, which he edited and conceived, is Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York, a great book of photographs, and a great interview with Martin Scorsese about basically New York as a character in film. And what's fascinating to me is the story that Sidney Lumet tells about basically having to pay $400 a day in 1960s prices to pay cops off because you had to basically pay off every precinct that you shot in. So I guess that really set him up for making Serpico, just learning about corruption firsthand.
Well, that was one of the great innovations of the mayor's film office, was not just improving the way that the permit system worked, but creating a special unit of the police department whose job it would be to work with these film crews and help them stop traffic and do whatever they needed to do. Until that time, basically, the filmmaker had to go to the local precinct, wherever he was shooting, and there are, you know, obviously dozens of precincts in New York, and typical film shoot might go all over the city. You might have to deal with four different precinct captains, and convince them why it was worth their time to take officers off their regular job as, you know, catching criminals and doing whatever else they were doing, and help a commercial production. When you put it in those terms, you realize the police captain's going, well, this isn't going to help me with my crime stats or anything like that. What's in it for me? And yes, they used to budget in, as Sidney says, they used to budget in a certain amount per day for all the cops. That stopped. Sidney and others have said, you know, it got to the point where you couldn't buy these guys a cup of coffee because it was no longer sort of the side job. It was now the main job of this high-profile unit with the mayor looking and everybody looking down their shoulders. So some argue, was even more important than the permitting improvements that they did, because once you had that crew that allowed you to go out in the city, shut the streets you needed to do, and do whatever else it was that you needed to do, including if you had a gun chase and they had firearms and stuff like that, and, you know, big deal, that really made it a friendly place to work.
The Scorsese Q&A is really terrific. And one of the things I love about it is him talking about seeing Naked City shot down at what is now Soho, mm-hmm. and just how unusual that was mm-hmm. to see, when he was a kid, to see anybody filming anything in New York.
Yeah, I just asked a kind of obvious thing. What was the first location shoot you ever saw? Never mind was in, but saw. And he said, well, watching the old Naked City television show being done, was sort of fondly remembered show from 1959, 1960, being shot down on Elizabeth Street, sort of the end of his block, his very insular little Italy community in those days. And he said, nobody came down there, no outsiders came down there, but there was, you know, the crew and the cast. And he said it was just, he said the actors' faces had a kind of strength to them, and the lights, and there was a rain machine, and he was fascinated to see how they were doing the artificial rain.
You get him to talk about the picture window he sat in as a kid that was basically sort of his first film frame, which is really basically sets up who Martin Scorsese is in a way I've never seen before.
Well, he describes just what you would see when you looked out that window, the life on Elizabeth Street, and he just makes it so vivid that it just hit me that it's like the establishing shot of a film where he's just taking you to this sort of culture, this insular ethnic, you know, Italian immigrant community, and he's talking about the butcher and the pork seller and the, you know, the kids running around and, you know, teasing the cops. And I just realized, sure, him all those hours, you know, he was not a well boy when he was young. He was sort of a sickly boy. And all those hours he spent just looking out that window was, you know, the frame of the window being the equivalent of the movie camera. Was really kind of where it all began for him.
It's fascinating, too, to hear him basically claim movies that weren't even shot in Manhattan, like On the Waterfront. It felt like a movie that came out of his neighborhood to him.
Yes. You know, even though it was shot in Hoboken, it was effectively the same kind of community. And I certainly included in the book, it was certainly a New York production. Scenes, of course, there's the skyline of Manhattan is in, you know, a big presence in the film. And it's about the port of New York, which in those days was, as it was called in those days, which, you know, included the New Jersey side of the harbor. And all the interior work and all that was shot, and this was the big deal, was shot on stages in New York, in the old Fox stage, like the, you know, it could have been a Contender scene, did not happen in Hollywood, happened in New York.
Obviously, all those movies that he saw, and that, even that location mm-hmm. shooting and sitting in that house, shaped his conception of New York, the New York that he wanted to put on film.
That's right. Although he had a kind of a love, as he said, he also had a love of the Hollywood New York and the high side. He remembers the high curbs that he would see in the old MGM, you know, set films. But, yeah, he said that, you know, Lumet's work, early work, you know, he was stunned by Lumet's early films and several of the other filmmakers. And he describes very vividly, you know, the mix of influences that was going on at NYU when he was a student, in which you had all the European impact of the New Wave and the realist, neorealists that had come a little bit before, and then the documentarians who were working at the time.
And the first Naked City, which is the first film really to be shot in the streets of New York in 1947.
Exactly. And that, I think, was a turning point, because he was really defining a kind of a New York hybrid filmmaking tradition that he himself, thanks to, you know, his prominence and the prominence of the films he made, became, you know, the basis of what we would now call the independent film industry.
Did you know that at one point Hitchcock wanted to shoot what became Frenzy on the streets of New York? He actually did some camera tests. Mm-hmm. He met with Godard, and he was fascinated by Godard's fascination with him. And he thought, well, if this guy's trying something new, I want to try something new. And he actually went out and did some camera tests. It's mentioned in the book Hitchcock's Notebooks by Dan Uller. And what happens is he just couldn't get Universal to go along with them, rather fight with them. He just went and shot stuff back on a backlog.
That's interesting. Well, he had a kind of teasing, complicated relations with locations. We have a quote from Bob Boyle, the art director, saying he didn't like locations because it was, you know, he was a control freak and he wanted everything just so. And that was one of the things you did get on a backlot set. You got everything just so. And he did do, of course, some incredible, you know, The Wrong Man and then scenes in North by Northwest and some other, you know, things that were very striking. But he was never comfortable. He said that, Boyle said that they filled Grand Central Terminal with more lights than they would have ever used in an MGM set, you know, just so it could be lighted just so for what Hitchcock wanted.
It's the treatment, my guess, is architect James Sander. His book he edited and conceived is Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York. Again, it's a great book. And one of the things I was really fascinated by was that period where it's basically Lindsay said, let's make movies here, happened to be a period where filmmakers show what an awful place New York
exactly.
was.
Horror City, as Pauline Kael called it. And that was one of the great ironies, that in this kind of goal to just kind of bring New York on screen, it was in 1966. Okay, 66 was all right, but by 68 and 69, the mood of the city was getting decidedly dark. And then you had this period from maybe 69 to 77 or so, 78, that were, you know, without question, the worst years in the life of New York in, you know, more than a century. You know, it's hard to, maybe the Civil War draft riots or something you'd have to go back to. But and there were the filmmakers. Now, ironically, it coincided with this extraordinary outburst of creativity in the American film business, a lot of which was centered in New York. So it was one of the glorious moments of you know, arguably of American culture and New York culture in particular, when you had, you know, movies, just let's run through a list, Midnight Cowboy and French Connection and Mean Streets and Taxi Driver and early Woody Allen films and you know, The Godfather, and going on and on and on.
And these, Death Wish, even.
Death Wish, you know, all of these films, but in many of them, like Death Wish, were not really great works of art, but gave the worst possible view of New York that you could possibly imagine, and really became a kind of a problem that it took, I think, 20 years. I think it's only really been in the last 10 years that New York has gotten out from under the image that it had for all those years from those movies.
But as that kind of backlot, the city becoming the great studio, as Scorsese put it, you got films like Wolfen, which kind of showed how devastated New York was, or Fort Apache, the Bronx. And there was, in these great films that we're talking about, a vitality and verve in the filmmaking that sort of made all that decay and deterioration romantic.
I know. I think kids come to New York now and they're sort of, what happened to the good old days when these villages looked like a slum and now it's all gentrified? But of course, there was a kind of a cartoony aspect, certainly, to things like Wolfen. You know, they sort of turned what was a very real tragic issue going on with very complicated social causes, the sort of devastation of the South Bronx, into basically the backdrop of their kind of science fiction-y movie. So I'm not sure that it was like a great contribution to urban understanding.
But Fort Apache, the Bronx certainly tried to
dramatize. Yes, it did. It did. It tried in its script. They were very sensitive to it. It was a very controversial film. There were a lot of attacks on it while it was being made and after it came out. And they had to add, you know, a disclaimer at the beginning of it saying, oh, by the way, we didn't bother with all the decent people of the Bronx, wherever they might be. We just were making this about policemen. And but it is a little, I mean, none of it, no film, you know, very, very little film violence and action ever resembles real, you know, real troubles. It's always a projection about fears and violence, whether it's Death Wish or Fort Apache or any of these films. They're really about our fears more than they are about actual social problems.
You mentioned one of my favorite films, though, The Landlord,
yes,
which is set in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And that was, to all extent and purposes, a slum in those days.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it couldn't be more gentrified than that stuff. But it's a wonderful movie,
it's
actually.
It's rich and complicated. Now, that's an example of a film that I think was a remarkably rich film about a very serious topic that was really not on the radar at the time. And the sort of kooky, Beau Bridges playing this kind of kooky white guy.
I should say the first film directed by Hal Ashby.
By Hal Ashby, starting a very distinguished career, sadly short, I think. Terrific cast, highlighting a lot of wonderful African-American performers of the day. And set in basically in a still poor, largely African-American area of Park Slope. And this white kid comes with dreams of taking over a brownstone and turning it into his own little sort of clubhouse.
And rebelling against his family.
Lee Grant doing a wonderful turn and his mother. And then he finds, because he can't get the building permits in time, that he has to kind of live in the building with everybody in the building, including Pearl Bailey and this incredible cast of characters.
Dinah Sands, Lou Gossett.
Some of whom are, Pearl is kind of the earth mother who kind of takes him in, but some of the others are very hostile. Then he has these kind of complicated, you know, romantic relationships. And he gets himself, he finds that he begins to change. And so it's a very interesting, complicated story. And I think well told and well shot right there. They shot it on this, I think it was right between 5th and 6th Avenue in Park Slope.
We'll take a break from all this location scouting. My guest is architect James Sanders. His book is Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell.
Shake it, don't break it.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. We're talking about the amazing book, Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York. Its editor, the architect James Sanders, and the man who conceived the book. I want to ask you how this book sort of changed or some of your conceptions about New York just as a student of architecture, just seeing all the different kinds to go from Brooklyn to Harlem to the
Coney Island. One thing I think is that, and one reason I would suggest it might be fun for people to read it or buy it, is that it tells the story of the last four decades of New York, or five decades really, in an incredibly evocative way. We've all lived through, those of us who lived in the city this period or some period of it, have lived through these amazing changes. And I went to college at Columbia in the sort of mid-70s. And to see a movie like Up the Sandbox and to see pictures to remind myself of how grim the Upper West Side used to look and how family unfriendly it was.
Until the 90s.
Until the 90s. Nowadays, of course, it's like a suburban district but with strollers everywhere. But there are shots of poor Barbara Streisand trying to yank her stroller around down the steps of what I vividly remember, these sort of grim apartment fortresses on 111th Street. Is really be taken back to a city that was really a different place than today. And so, going around, seeing all the different kinds of architecture. Harlem, you mentioned, we have some extraordinary shots. We have one view that was from the film Sugar Hill that shows really in a single shot, and this is the kind of thing I love, you've seen the entire history of Harlem because it's got the tenements that were really the kind of key building block of much of Harlem in the foreground, and then the high-rise housing projects in the distance. So it's a kind of a shot that moves not only through space but through time. And it's those kind of images that really stay with you. But you also have shots also from Sugar Hill reminding people that because Harlem was poor for so long, its buildings didn't get torn down or changed very much, so that they remains architecturally one of the richest parts of the city.
The gentrification hasn't quite extended that far yet.
Yeah.
You also have stuff from one of my favorite Harlem movies. And the first movie to shoot in Harlem really is Cotton Comes to Harlem. Davis's Cotton Comes to Harlem.
Which was, is kind of thrown in as part of the blaxploitation period. But, is a very rich portrait of the, goes, if you actually follow the film, it virtually travels river to river across Harlem. And you see every different kind of part of life, much more complicated than and interesting and complex than you would think. And really the old idea that two detectives, that is a kind of very old urban trope, that the detective is actually your perfect guide because he can go, like a newspaper reporter, he can sort of go anywhere in the city. He can go from the high to the low. He can see the good sides of life, the bad sides of life. And that's his job, really. He's going around. He's trying to discover something. But along the way, he shows you a place. And so the two wonderful, amusing and kind of alternatively kind of canny, cunning and amusing detectives in the film walk you through Harlem and show you the anatomy of the place circa 1970.
It's The Treatment. My guest is architect James Sanders. His book, which he conceived and edited, is Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York. I wonder if there are movies that you were looking at over the process of putting the book together, you sort of changed your mind about something you came to like more than others. I can't imagine you were ever a fan of Sugar Hill. It's not a very good movie.
No, there are a lot. What I do find interesting is that sometimes films that are less good can still have a sort of redeeming value as kind of wonderful through some terrific cinematography or location shooting or whatever. Panic in Needle Park, for example, was a film that I'd watched, I think, once.
Talk about the Upper West Side.
Probably about the Upper West Side. People that don't know it, it's a kind of a very sympathetic portrait of drug dealers, basically, drug addicts, anyway.
With Al Pacino in his first starring role.
Al Pacino in his first starring role, and people like Raul Julia in small parts, and a lot of local guys, and a lot of Upper West Sider, actually. They actually just sort of went around. Shot by Adam Hollander, directed by Jerry Schatzberg, and amazing sort of portrait of the Upper West Side in those days, but also a kind of a remarkable film in its own right.
Well, as Nora Ephron mentions in the sort of the end paper of the book, the Upper West Side was Needle Park. 72nd
right.
and Broadway
That's
was
right.
where you went to score in those
That's
days.
That's right, exactly.
I guess just thinking about so many of the movies in the book, what sort of strikes me, I still keep going back to the Scorsese interview you did, mm-hmm. where you bring up the fact that in the same year, the same 10-month period, he shot Taxi Driver, and Woody Allen shot Annie Hall, both of which were very different kinds of Valentines, if you will, to New York.
They're both amazing portraits. They're both portraits of a city. They're filtered through two incredibly different, but I think fascinatingly complementary film intelligences, and very, by the way, mutually admiring. We have, you know, Marty saying wonderful things about Woody Allen, and Woody acknowledging that, you know, Scorsese's view is not his, but he, you know, he can respond to it and see it and see what Scorsese's doing. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is interesting that the city is there. It's a very complicated place. And then filmmakers can go in and pull out and make their own city. And I think Annie Hall is a romantic, wonderful vision of a kind of Upper East Side, you know, romantic way of life. And Taxi Driver, and it bears not particularly great relation to reality, but Taxi Driver is the same. It's, you know, a complete fantasy, you know, and it's really done in phantasmagorical terms. And it was its own kind of weird, strange, interesting vision of its director.
You also have two, basically within like the same 12 months or so, The Warriors, mm-hmm. Manhattan, mm-hmm. and The Wiz.
Mm-hmm.
Which are also three very different views in New York for about the same time period.
That's right. And also, again, proof of what a rich, you know, heritage was going on. The Warriors, which is there's a film that really is, I think people don't know how good a film that is.
It's really a tour, literally, of a subway map of Manhattan.
Literally. I mean, you know, for one thing, drawing its basic storyline from the fourth, from an epic from written by Epictetus from the 4th century A.D., but then really coming to life with this film that is a kind of a portrait of the subway system, in which the subway system becomes this kind of universe of this amazing night journey that this gang takes from one end of the city to the other and back. So that's an interesting film. The Wiz, kind of a complicated, flawed film, but an interesting attempt to kind of use elements of the real city. We have a shot of the scene in the World Trade Center Plaza. It's kind of moving to see today. And then Manhattan, you know, sort of the ultimate kind of love letter to the city, shot in black and white using this incredibly wide Panavision format and kind of those incredible tour de force opening and close in which the city is really brought, now, I wouldn't say a character, but it comes this active presence, let's say, in the lives of the characters of the film. And whereas Annie Hall was sort of a little defensive, in Manhattan he's going full bore and going, you know what, this place is going to survive. This is just too amazing an environment to stay down. So I think there's a kind of a confidence to it that was mirroring what was going on in the city itself.
You are undertaking a project for Turner Classic Movies, I'd like you to talk about a little bit.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Well, it's based on my first book, Celluloid Skyline, which tells the whole story, not focusing only on location shooting, but really the 100-year love affair between New York and the movies, going all the way back to the 1890s and the first movies ever made by
Edison. And really a look at how the city has changed geographically.
Exactly. And really about the architecture of the city, taking in the studio era in Hollywood when the great challenge was rebuilding the city. And what we're going to be doing is taking over Grand Central Terminal's Vanderbilt Hall, the old waiting room there, and putting up these amazing artifacts that I found in the course of doing my research. And just to whet your appetite, we're going to have the actual scenic backing paintings that were created for North by Northwest and The Clock. These are the actual paintings of the United Nations that Cary Grant ran in front of, and of old Pennsylvania Station that Judy Garland and Robert Walker posed in front of for Vincent Minnelli's The Clock. And they're the size of houses. And then we're also going to have the old process plate footage that they used, which was actually footage of the real city that would be brought to California to be put behind actors, shot from the back. And we're going to bring some of that to the space. And then there'll be about 160 of the images from the book, all filling the room and making a kind of a magical urban environment coming to life. And that's going to open in late May of 2007. And TCM is sponsoring the show and will be doing a block of associated programming on the network.
It's The Treatment, my guest is architect James Sander. The book he edited and conceived, an amazing picture book of the history of New York from 1965 to the present in movies, is Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York. The thing that sort of fascinates me about that, though, is thinking about one person who probably had more material made about New York than any other person, which would be Neil Simon,
mm-hmm.
who simultaneously has stuff that was really studio-bound,
mm-hmm.
And then also stuff that's shot right in the streets of, like the prisoner of Second Avenue.
That's right. It was, you know, certainly for a long period, kind of the ex-New York playwright. And, what would you say? I mean, he had so many laughs and so many good, solid, like, you know, solid entertainment value to his plays that I think he was too successful to have his films actually be sort of indie New York films. Hollywood, you know, guys like, you know, Ross and those other directors, you know, Herbert Ross, they would just pick that stuff up and you could get that made, you know, like Plaza Suite and those films could just be made by Paramount.
It's fascinating to see The Out of Towners, a movie that feels much darker. Looking back at it now, than anything else he ever did, and it actually has like, that cameo by Sylvester Stallone as a mugger.
Yes, well, it's an interesting. That's actually Prisoner of Second Avenue.
Sorry, you're right.
But that moment where, as I say, New York was in such trouble that the darkest films being made about it were comedies, which is The Out of Towners and Prisoner of Second Avenue is supposed to be funny, and it's supposed to be funny. You know, ha-ha, that New York is, like, falling apart at the seams. And certainly The Out-of-Towners is kind of the quintessential film on that. But Prisoner of Second Avenue, I think, holds up as a kind of portrait of a kind of middle class. He was – that's an actually prescient film because it was in the era of still large, job stability for middle class guys. But you could look forward to that as being a little bit like the film with Michael Douglas to say, you know, set in L.A. years later about, you know, what does it take – you know, what's the veneer of middle class life and what does it take for that to break?
You're talking about falling down.
About falling down, so yes. And looking forward to a sort of a less comfortable, less, you know, a more angst-ridden period where just being middle class wouldn't necessarily give you, you know, protection.
Yeah, I thought about that film because that's one sort of the one creator, if you will, who you wouldn't expect to make mm-hmm. or to be responsible for a film that had that same kind of sort of decrepit heartbeat as these other films that we're talking
about. That's right, yeah. And the whole film, remember, has like little bulletins that are coming in over the course of the film, like from a war zone. And my point about it in a more made in celluloid skyline is that, if everything was going bad in New York, at least your apartment was your kind of middle class bastion, protection, your bulwark against the bad things in life. But when the apartment began to go, which is what happens in the thieves break into their apartment. They're fighting with the guys upstairs. They're yelling out the window. Then what's left? There's nothing left.
You mentioned this, and this will be my last question. You remind me of that great point you make in the Scorsese interview about how New York, of those movies, that period seemed like a Northern European or a Nordic mm-hmm. city, a much mm-hmm. more sort of severe mm-hmm. and austere, and people and those buildings being kind of these coal edifices, and it's much more multicultural.
That's
place
right,
now.
And kind of Latin flavored, a Mediterranean flavored in every way. Not only is obviously the population much sort of more diverse and broader, but you know, outdoor cafes, something as simple as that. New York didn't have outdoor cafes in the 1960s. It felt like it was a winter city, like it was almost like a Scandinavian city or something like that. Certainly like London. And now, of course, the fact is the climate is actually pretty good most of the time. And, a lot of the life of the city has now moved out into the streets. You have all the ethnic parades. You have the festivals. That just didn't exist. I'm old enough to remember New York in which that was just really not part of the daily life of the city. So it has changed. And I mentioned that to Scorsese, and he absolutely agreed and pointed out the problem that they would have in the old Italian districts, which although they were Italian, quote unquote, they were very kind of they all dressed in black and they were all very serious. And then when the Latino influx came and they started painting the walls like tangerine color and things like that, the old Italians were having none of it.
We're out of time. James, thanks so much for doing this.
Well, it's my pleasure.
The book, again, is Scenes from the City, Filmmaking in New York. It's edited by James Sanders, produced with the Mayor's Office of Film, Theater, and Broadcasting. Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with technical assistance from Noriko Okabe. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Bradley produces the show. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.